EcoLogic.org. Coming up next is EcoLogic. The last 8 p.m. episode of EcoLogic. We move until to 11 a.m. next week. So I'm Ken Gale and...
I'm Donna Stein.
And so stay tuned. We have a really interesting show this time.
A parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
If they keep on polluting the earth and telling where we gonna plant our seed, it makes me wanna cry.
See a windmill go, feel the pull of an ocean wave, the heat from a volcano. There's so much we could do, there's so much we could know, if we listen to the earth.
Every day is Earth Day. I'm Ken Gale.
And I'm Donna Stein.
And this is EcoLogic for March 10th, 2020, here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. When your air or water is clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said.
On today's news and announcements,
Earth Mom.
Pesticide bill delay.
Another radio station drops the ball.
New dangers at Indian Point.
And it's with a heavy heart that we make the following announcements. Some of you may know Verena Reich because she was active on so many issues, from peace and housing to East River Environmental Coalition and writing songs with the New York City Raging Grannies. Her memorial was attended by a member of Congress and members of the New York City and New York State legislatures. She was 77.
This week... this voice was silenced.
Come downstairs to the comedy show.
Earth Mom produced and hosted one of WBA's other environmental shows. Helena Mail and Ken broadcast together from the Clearwater Hudson Revival Music Festival last year.
And several other times.
Yeah. And Helena's show, which was usually on at night or very early in the morning, she produced several comedy or cabaret benefits for WBAI and was a great example of a well-prepared, well-thought-out show that combined artistic and public affairs elements. To listen to past shows of hers, go to WBAI.org and click on Missed a Show, then put Earth Mom in the search box. To be notified when the memorial to Helena is, email remembering earth mum at wbai.org. That's remembering earth mum at WBI.org.
And she was very active on the Standing Rock pipeline issue and just a wonderful team player and a good friend, too. And then an hour after I heard about Helena passing, I heard about the passing of my longtime friend, Abby. She was a science fiction fan and a fanish songwriter, probably my most eccentric friend.
It's been a tough time. When a bill gets a large majority of sponsors, you expect it will be passed into law, right? Mm-mm. Not so for the bill to keep poisonous pesticides out of schoolyards, parks, and playgrounds. Even with 35 out of 51 New York City Council members sponsoring it, the chair of the Health Committee, Mark Levine, is stopping the vote. I hear it's for personal political reasons. Not good. Call Councilman Levine and tell him to let the pesticide bill out of committee. We need this for our communities. Bill number 1524. 1524. His number is 212-788-7007. 212-788-7007. Call Mark Levine. Tell him to let the pesticide bill go out of committee.
A friend of mine called me to tell me about a show on another radio station about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It started out as a fluff piece about the indigenous people who live there in peace with the environment and what oil and gas drilling will do to their lives. But the ending made me livid. They gave energy choices as different types of poison power. They disregarded renewable energy and didn't even mention simply using less energy by not wasting it, by being more efficient in how we use it. Not what the writers of the show thought about.
They even repeated the stupid bridge fuel argument. Use fossil fuel, make climate change worse until some hazy future when we go renewable. It will take just as long, maybe longer, to put in the drill structures and the infrastructure to bring the fossil fuel to market as it will to put up more renewable energy. We know what we need to do, folks, and it will only take a fraction of the time to make our buildings, cars, and lives more energy efficient. A fraction of the time, cutting fossil fuel pollution right away. Solar panel installer is the fastest growing job in the United States, thankfully. But that station takes money from fossil fuel companies to underwrite their programming. Well, WBAI does not.
We can tell you the whole truth, not part of the truth. Please support WBAI financially. The change in the Pacifica Foundation bylaws that some people in California want will undoubtedly take away local programming, such as Ecologic. I say that because the people behind the change took away all local programming in October. The bylaws they're proposing are leaving out the Pacifica mission statement itself.
There's a corporation called Holtec that is buying up nuclear power plants that are being decommissioned. Sounds like they have good intentions, right? Nah. They have a history of incompetence and cutting corners and using connections in Washington to get away with it. With all of the Indian Point nuclear power plants radioactive waste stored on site, Holtec is not a company that should be in charge, not a company that we can feel confident with. New York Attorney General Letitia James opposes the Holtec transfer. Go, Letitia. Hudson River Sloop Clearwater, Riverkeeper, and other environmental groups are encouraging people to contact the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to tell them not to allow Holtec to take over Indian Point. We link to Clearwater's details on why Holtec is a bad idea on our EcoLinks page.
For years, environmentalists have been warning about putting a high-pressure gas pipeline a few yards from a nuclear power plant. For years, we've had rallies, shown the science, written to politicians and government agencies, gone to court, done civil disobedience, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, just rubber-stamped the project as usual. Finally, the faulty science used to justify the approval has come to light and hit the mainstream a little, and a new pipeline analysis is going to be done. We link to an article on a local online mainstream newspaper, Patch, from our EcoLinks page.
Environment TV airs on Manhattan Community Network every Sunday at 11 a.m. and is often a video version of this show, Ecologic. If you miss any WBI show, it should be on the WBI.org archives 5 or 10 minutes after the show ends. To read the full articles we summarize on any episode of Ecologic from the past few years, we link to all of those articles on the Ecolinks page of Eco-Logic website, www.ecoradio.org. Go there to link to all the URLs from the show. Ecologic is moving to 11 a.m. every Tuesday. Did we say that before? Can we say that again? Let's let you guys know. This is our last evening show, and we are now moving to 11 a.m. on Tuesdays. So if you can't make it on 11 a.m., we are on the archives.
Yep. Our Facebook page is WBAI Ecologic. No spaces or dashes. WBAI Ecologic. Please click like. There are links to more environmental news on our Ecolinks page. So ecoradio.org is the main Ecologic page, and that'll get you to past guests, Ecolinks, and our own permanent archives, ecoradio.org. Keep that website bookmarked in case the bylaws get changed and Ecologic is canceled. Oh. Donna, Charlie, and I will keep it going. And I want to thank Sema and Ann for inspiring this show. Explaining bits of science that sort of gets glossed over in the mainstream, no matter how complex it is. And it's the second show that we've done inspired by an article in Scientific American, and also the second time that the Scientific American article wasn't really the best way of presenting the issue. Last time it was about masculinity and environmentalism. And this time we have Anne-Marie Diancote. Is that the right pronunciation?
That's about right.
And she has a background in molecular biology and genetics and did her PhD studying speciation. Speciation is how different species of animals develop, how they evolve. It's really interesting because, you know, you walk in any ecosystem, woods, the beach, a meadow, whatever, and there's all these different species of plants and animals and insects and under your feet, microbes. And it's like, how come there are so many different species? Why are there so many different ways of growing and of eating? And so we're going to go into detail on why that is. With Anne-Marie. So thanks for joining us on Ecologic and WBAI.
You're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
So I guess let's start with that. Why are there so many different species?
that's actually a very good question, a question to which we're actively looking for an answer, I guess, to a certain extent. Part of the answer actually lies in what you just said in the introduction. You mentioned the ecosystem, the diversity of the ecosystem, right? The diversity of resources that are around us. And so that creates opportunities for populations to specialize onto those resources and eventually become isolated from other similar populations and perhaps eventually diverge into actual good species.
So how does evolution work in nature?
That's another very broad question.
We have 45 minutes.
Usually when people think of evolution, they think probably of Darwin and his theory of evolution by natural selection. We know this is part of the answer. So the environment in which I include biological species, in which I include natural resources, water streams, do create opportunities for species to gradually evolve, perhaps adapt to these different variables. So this is sort of the gradualistic way of seeing evolution, but now we also know that evolution sometimes proceeds much faster, sometimes in a few generations, new species might actually arise.
That's an interesting concept, how we think of evolution as happening over tens of thousands of years, but mm-hmm. in your studies, you found that there is some species specialization that happens in a much shorter time.
And, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, is that what punctuated equilibrium is?
It sort of is. I'm not entirely familiar with this theory. I think it refers mostly to the fossils, right? Fossil record that doesn't show this sort of gradualism you might expect.
Yeah, Stephen Jay Gould was a paleontologist, and he was one of the creators of the theory of punctuated equilibrium, which he said is a type of evolution. The creationists were actually using it to combat evolution, and he jumped mm-hmm. all over the talk show circuit saying, no, that's evolution too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so thanks for refreshing my memory. So, yes, then you're entirely right. So, the fossil record may actually sometimes look incomplete. That can be for geological reasons, but there are also evolutionary reasons. And those reasons are actually the fact that at times evolution seems to proceed extremely fast for reasons that we understand well in some cases and don't understand very well in others.
But it's safe to say that having large, diverse numbers of species only helps the ecosystem.
Definitely. And it varies at different latitudes. Of course, there's more diversity at the equator than there is in the Arctic for a number of reasons that relate to ecological opportunities, among other things. The health of the ecosystem, if you will, greatly relies on having this diversity of species where they're all interconnected to each other, right?
Yeah, I remember a study from Columbia a few years ago where they took a meadow and partitioned it into 100 different sections, 10 by 10.
I'm sorry, what did they take?
They took a very large meadow, and mm-hmm. and they partitioned it, basically just lines on it, and they varied what was growing in each of those parcels, because of course mm-hmm. the actual environment is very complex and hard to understand. So they figured, well, if we simplify it, we can understand it better. And one of the things they learned is that biodiversity is more important than biomass, that you get more oxygen, you absorb more carbon dioxide, things grow better. Everything is better with biodiversity and over sheer biomass.
Exactly. And this is because different species are actually specialized or more adapted to utilize certain resources that may then be used by a second species that may transform, you know, the mass into something else that can then be used by a third species. So they're all interconnected, right, with these ecosystem links, if you will.
All the more reason that your studies are so important, that we understand the evolution of the diversity.
Exactly. So one of the systems I studied during my short career, I guess, during my PhD, I worked on the lake whitefish system. It's a salmonid closely related to Atlantic salmon or lake trout, if you will. And what's very particular in this group of species is that they seem to rapidly specialize within a lake, so different populations form within a single lake, and they seem to be specialized for different food resources. So one of the species is actually benthic, and it tends to eat large prey.
What's benthic?
The benthic, the normal lake whitefish. So benthic means at the bottom, mostly at the bottom of the lake. So it will feed on larger prey. And then there's a limnetic, so in the water column form, which is dwarf, that is specialized on smaller prey. And so we think that these two specialized forms of lake whitefish are actually undergoing the process of speciation. But they're very early in the process of speciation, probably less than 50,000 years.
Well, so basically they want to hang out with their friends.
Exactly. And then the more they hang out with their friends, the more differentiated they become from each other, right? And so what's interesting, in a very similar system in Europe, there has been a competitor of one of these two forms that was introduced. And so the competitor was feeding on the small prey as the dwarf form. And so there was actually speciation reversal. So the dwarf form and the normal form actually merge into a single population due to the introduction of a third species that actually disturbed the ecosystem, if you will. So I guess what I'm getting at is that, as you were saying, you know, every species has its role in the ecosystem, and that sort of equilibrium can be very fragile and disturbed easily. For example, by introducing a new species.
That's just the point I was just going to make. Is there any danger of invasive species
definitely.
Being introduced?
Yeah, definitely.
That's a big problem. That's a big problem in the Mississippi and a few other places.
Exactly. Are you referring to the Asian carp?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, Asian carp, they actually feed on pretty much everything. And so they're displacing, actually, very rapidly eliminating other species, other competitors. And that's, you know, disturbing the entire ecosystem.
And I remember, I guess it was back in the 70s or 60s when the zebra mussel was introduced into Lake Erie and mm-hmm. basically reproduced like crazy, had no local enemies. And it took decades for an equilibrium in the lake to form, but an equilibrium did form. At one point, they took a Volkswagen, put it in the lake, and within a few days, it was covered with these zebra mussels. and nowadays that wouldn't happen because there's an equilibrium. So is there a chance that that Asian carp could find an equilibrium, or will it literally destroy the Mississippi ecosystem?
I'm rather pessimistic. It's very hard to make predictions for the exact reason that you mentioned. The Asian carp doesn't seem to have any natural predator in that ecosystem. So it looks like there's nothing to control it right now and to bring back that equilibrium.
I guess a predator is going to have a much greater effect than something like a mussel, which is a type of clam. And now the Scientific American article, I think, hit a lot of people's imagination because it was about birds. And birds are very popular. There's tens of millions of bird enthusiasts in the United States. And so when it talked about birds, everybody is sort of paying attention. And you were one of the scientists mentioned in that article. When I called Cornell University's Lab of Ornithology to talk about it, they did not want to talk about that article. They don't like it. And they said, why don't you talk to one of the primary scientists? And they sent me to you. And when I read the original article in Nature, I'm like, oh, no wonder they don't like the Scientific American article, because they were kind of exaggerating a bit, overstating what was going on.
Exactly.
So tell us about some of the research you did.
So what we studied is called a germline restricted chromosome. So the germline is actually the reproductive organ, right? In males and female human, it's the ovaries and the testes, right? So these birds, the bird which we studied is the zebra finch. So it's a model species used a lot in neurobiology and behavior, mainly because it can learn how to sing. And so what's particular, or we thought was particular with that species and its sister species, the Bengalese finch, is that they have this germline restricted chromosome. So basically they have an extra chromosome that is only found within their germline, and it's eliminated from all the other cells of the organism. So this is how it gets transmitted to the next generation by the germline, right, when the egg is born within the female. But then as the embryo develops, the chromosome gets eliminated from the other cell.
Wait a minute. They eliminate chromosomes?
Exactly.
They just eliminate them.
It gets kicked out.
Now, is that what is new to your study?
So this was previously known. What we didn't know when we started this work is whether this chromosome has a function or if it may perhaps just be a parasite. So we didn't know what it did. We didn't know what genes it may contain. We had no idea what its function might be. And so what we did was to actually sequence it.
What does that mean, sequencing?
So getting down to the actual DNA sequence, the four letters that constitute the sequence of the chromosomes, repeated hundreds of times.
So DNA is made up of these four acids that are denoted by letters.
Correct. So four nucleotides, A, T, G, and C, which are repeated over and over. In the case of the human genome, it's about 3 billion times. It's a little less in the case of birds, roughly a billion of times.
Who counts?
Oh, only a billion.
Exactly. And so in that germline-restricted chromosome, it's roughly 12% of those letters that are contained on this chromosome. So for us, it was a really fascinating question to look at its sequence and try to understand what it might be doing based on that.
And every once in a while, you'll hear on some news report about genes being turned on and off, and they never explain it because they're too busy with their sound bites. But we have more than a soundbite here on WBAI, and you're listening to Ecologic on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Ken Gale.
And I'm Donna Stein.
And we're with Emmerine Dion Cote and talking about why the ecosystem is the way it is, right down to the genetic level.
And we just had a friend of ours who's in the studio, Hazel, who's making calls on our phone bank to people to get them to vote for the new changes of the bylaws. We can tell you how to vote, but we have to tell you to vote. And you can go to 917-781-0366. That's in order to get more information on that.
May I repeat that number?
Yeah, 917-781-0366. And Hazel was just amazed that genes could actually be changed and be affected. And so I think we need to talk to Hazel right now and tell and say why this is.
What does it mean when a gene turns off or turns on?
So perhaps I can revise with you some notions about the genome and what's a gene, basically. So what we call a genome is more or less a great recipe book that contains the recipes to make a human or a bird or a dog, right? And so it contains many, many different recipes, which we call genes, that are actually coding for proteins, right? So the genome contains many genes. These genes code for proteins. And so at a specific time within a specific cell, not all these genes are actually transformed into proteins to make a function in a cell. This is what makes the difference between a cell from the liver, a cell from your skin, a cell from your bones, right? It's because you express different genes. So some genes are turned on or turned off, and this is what makes a cell give the identity and the function of a cell. Does that make sense?
So in other words, the genes are simply not active.
Exactly.
The ATGC proteins and DNA, is that what you're talking about? Or
exactly. So the genes are sequences of ATGCs, et cetera, and then these codes for proteins, which are made of amino acids that actually do the function. So an example of a protein, which you may have heard of, would be the hemoglobin, which transports oxygen in your body.
In the bloodstream.
In the bloodstream, yeah. So this is an example of a protein encoded by a gene in your DNA.
So if that gene was turned off, then our body would not make hemoglobin.
Exactly. So it's turned on in the cells that make your red blood cells, where it's actually needed. But hemoglobin may not be needed in the cells of your skin. So in your skin, the gene coding for hemoglobin is turned off.
Oh, okay. So the body is sort of organizing itself as it develops.
Exactly. Expressing different genes, turning on different genes in different cell types to give them their specific function. So at a given time, within each cell of your body, you're actually turning on only some of the genes in your whole genome and not all of them at once.
So not all of our cells have the same genes.
And so this is... I'm sorry, keep going.
No, I mean, because I remember growing up and taking science classes, and we were told, you know, all our cells are genes. What makes you is in every cell of your body. But now we know better. That's not quite true, is it?
Exactly. So we're starting to understand a little more that this is not entirely true. One example that we've known for a long time are the cells, the white blood cells. So there are some genes involved in immunity that are different between different white blood cells. So we've known that for quite a bit of time. But apart from that, in human, at least, we believe that all the cells contain the same genome or the same genes. Now, this is why we got interested in the case of the zebrafinch and its germline restricted chromosome, right? The chromosome that is restricted to its reproductive organ. We realized that there was a significant proportion of the genome that was actually only present in the reproductive organs and not in the rest of the cells in the body.
So that's the certain cells of the body are specialized then.
Exactly. And so, we didn't know when we started that project, we didn't know whether those genes actually had a role, right, if they had a function. Now, we haven't been able yet to clearly show that this is the case, but we did realize that some of the genes that are on the germline-restricted chromosome are actually expressed or turned on in the testis and the ovaries in other species. So now we're starting to get hints that the germline-restricted chromosome might actually be involved in reproductive function. in the zebra finch.
That brings to mind there is a lot of disruption in reproductive function among species, including humans. Is something in your work going to help find the answers to that huge problem?
We could wish for that in the long run. The explanation might be a little tricky to get at. But what I could mention definitely is that you're talking about reproductive isolation. We're talking about reproductive function, and that brings me to the very definition of a species. So what's a species? A species is actually a population, members of a population that can actually or potentially interbreed. If they cannot interbreed, then they are two different species. And so this is why we sort of suggested in the initial article that the germline restricted chromosome might potentially be involved in reproductive isolation and eventually speciation.
So that's why they drew the conclusion in Scientific American that this extra chromosome is why there are so many different species of songbirds.
Exactly. So what's very particular with the germline restricted chromosome, and this we need to investigate across many more species now, is that it seems to vary a lot between species in terms of size. So it probably varies a lot in terms of content. So another way of saying it, saying what I'm saying, is that is to say that it evolves rapidly. And genes that are typically involved in speciation tend to evolve rapidly. So you see, it's an interpretation. It's a potential explanation for rapid speciation among birds, but we're still very, very far from a causal link between the germline-restricted chromosome and speciation in birds.
It's like they're using statistics to draw conclusions. Since half of all bird species, 5,000 bird species, are songbirds, and they're the ones that have the extra chromosome, then that must be the reason that there are 5 out of 10,000 bird species have the extra chromosome, so that must be related in some way. But we don't know how it's related, right?
Exactly. So correlation does not equal causation is another way of saying this.
And
so we know, we made that observation that a very special group of birds contain that germline, have that germline restricted chromosome, but it's very, very hard to show an actual causal link between speciation and that restricted, germline-restricted chromosome.
And one of the most popular of all bird families for bird watchers are warblers. They're called the butterflies of the bird world. They're little, they're cute, they're active, and they're beautiful. And they're pretty much every color of the rainbow in different combinations, but they're all warblers. And so you think, well, there's so many different species of warblers. There must be a reason for it. And one of the things that Bert has noticed is that a mixed flock of warblers, like, say, 10 different species, will feed together. And they're not competing because they all prefer a different part of the tree. They all eat insects. Mm-hmm. But they're not competing because they're in a different part of the tree. And so that's an environmental cause of different species. That's not a genetic cause.
Exactly. So they've ecologically specialized on two different resources that are very close to each other. As you're saying, they're on the same tree. They're just in different parts of the tree.
And you kind of wonder if with the climate changing, then the food is going to change and if we're going to see either more or less species as a result.
Yeah, that's another very good point. So one of the predictions of climate change with respect to speciation is that it may increase the opportunity for hybridization between species. So species that perhaps did not see each other before climate change, following climate change, the environment changes, some geographical barriers may drop, and so they can now reproduce together, and this may force the merging of these two species within a single hybrid species or hybrid flock, if you will.
So birdwatchers that keep a list of all the species of birds they've seen in their life are going to see it shrink.
They could expect, they might see it shrink. They should definitely pay attention to that. Might see more hybrids. Warblers is a group, I believe, where we can see some hybridization in very specific zones. So we may see those hybridization events increase in terms of numbers.
With the hybridization, is it possible to create new species or new advances in species rather than less species?
It is possible, but it requires very strict conditions. So for this to happen, you need to have the hybrid that forms to be immediately reproductively isolated from its parental species. So only under those conditions that do not happen very often in nature will we see a new species form from a hybrid.
That could be exciting for someone like Ken, who's an avid birder. Ooh, something I've never seen or heard before.
Some new species there.
Yeah, but if it's at the expense of species I already know and love, that'll be sad to go with the excitement of something new. And I remember hearing a lecture by a Native American from British Columbia who was talking about the plants that they know very well don't live there. As the climate has changed, the ecosystem, of course, has changed with it. And so a plant that used to be in where they are legally tied to that part of land doesn't live there anymore. So they don't have knowledge of the new plant there. And then you have the complexity of insects don't change their range as quickly as plants, and then birds don't change their range as quickly as insects. So the entire ecosystem is out of balance. But then you were talking about the environment causing species. So I'm wondering if a bird is eating a different insect or an insect is eating a different plant, are they going to become a new species?
So can you reformulate your question, or can we divide your question?
If an insect is a certain species because of what it eats.
Yeah.
Right? This insect eats that, this insect eats the other thing. And now the ecosystem has changed because of climate change. And mm-hmm. now there's new plants living there, so the insect is eating something else. Mm-hmm. So is it going to change species because of its food is so different?
Yeah. So this sort of brings me to the speed and pace of evolution. So some people might argue, you know, with climate change or environmental change and ecosystem changes, well, species might adapt. This is going to create new opportunities and so on. The only issue with that is that, as we've discussed in the beginning, evolution tends to proceed slowly, sometimes rapidly, but most of the time slowly. And so one of the problems with current climate change is that it's occurring so rapidly, right?
Right.
In the area where I'm from, we used to have loads and loads of snow during the winter, and now there's rarely more than 3 feet at a time on the ground. So this type of change is way too rapid, we believe, and we do have evidence for that. Scientific evidence, too rapid for species to adapt and for the ecosystem to adapt and alleviate those type of changes that are occurring very, very rapidly.
Yeah, it's not enough that people will brush this off and say, well, survival of the species, they, it's just the way nature is. This is beyond nature. This is man-made climate change that's making it harder for the species to adapt. So
exactly. It's really the pace that is way beyond what is possible for nature to adapt, multiple systems to adapt.
So what we always like to talk about solutions on our show. Is there anything that you can think of that our listeners can do or read about or anything that we can do to
I think we need to be extremely proactive. I'm slowly leaning towards generating less and less garbage as much as I can. That's the thing on which we have the most power in our day-to-day life. Of course, voting for people that are proactive on those fronts is extremely important. Those are probably the two main things I can think of right now.
Well, whenever there's some legislation that you would like our listeners to know about, maybe you could pass on voting information that we can put on our ecoradio.org page. And
I'll pass it on.
Yeah.
And it sounds like, you know, that the science of genetics is very exciting right now because you're learning so many brand new things.
Yes, you're totally right. We've learned a lot of things in the 50s and 60s, you know, with the discovery of the structure of the DNA double helix and so on. And then it seemed like for quite a little bit, we were just, you know, trying to understand mechanism of single genes, how they might be turned on, turned off, and so on. And really what's happening right now is literally an explosion of data, mostly triggered by the advance of what we call next generation sequencing. There has been new technologies of DNA sequencing that were developed in the past 15 years or so. And so this allows us to study genetics in many, many more systems at a scale that is completely unprecedented.
Would you recommend if a parent has a child just entering college and they don't know what to do to look into genetics because it's such an exciting, growing field?
I definitely think that it's a good time to be a biologist, study genetics. A particularity with this flow of data in the field of genetics is that we cannot treat it by eye anymore, so we need computers. So there's more and more bioinformaticians and computational biologists. So it's a good combination. Combining biology and informatics is probably a very promising career path to think of.
So, Emery, we're coming up to the last few minutes of our show. Is there anything that you feel we've missed or that you'd want to let our listeners know about?
Perhaps you could ask me a few more questions. It's, you know, it's 1 hour later for me over here, so I'm getting a little...
I got it. I'm that way right now. But it's just marvelous to be able to talk to a four-syllable scientist and be able to get information that... our listeners can relate to, myself included. So we appreciate you, and I'm sure on our ecoradio.org page we'll have people asking additional questions.
All right, and I should thank Leo Campagna of Cornell, because he was the one who very strongly recommended that I contact you for this show.
Yes, thank you, Leo.
And it was it's almost like he wants to hear this show. he was so interested in what you wrote in your in the journal Nature that he wanted to know more.
We did have. I don't know if I've mentioned this when we talked previously, but I did work at Cornell, so I know Leo pretty well. And Leo works at the Lab of Ornithology, and so when I first started talking to Leo about that Deborah Finch germline restricted chromosome, they thought I was crazy. They couldn't believe it, right? And now that they saw that they see the paper out and all of the evidence that we've provided for the genes that we find on them, we don't know yet what it does, but we do have a few ideas of what it might be doing.
And this study is going to be going on for quite a while. And what is the point of studying genetics?
I think it's really about understanding the link between all organisms, right? What's common, what's shared between all living organisms is actually the DNA, the sequence. The sequence varies, of course, but the code itself is shared by all the organisms. And so understanding the mechanisms by which it's regulated, how it does it, and sometimes oddities like the germline restricted chromosome allows us to understand a little better about the world that surrounds us as well as ourselves.
So the more we learn about other creatures, the more we learn about ourselves, because there's relationships and seeing what the differences are also helps us learn about ourselves.
Exactly, because of the mechanisms that are shared and even some genes that are shared, actually a lot of genes that are shared between organisms.
Between mammals and...
And other kinds of mammals.
Oh, yeah, and even we share genes with bacteria, right? We all root down to a single common ancestor, whatever creationists might think.
So we can see the relationships, and so learning about them helps us deal with all the different things we have to go through in our everyday lives.
Exactly, and better understand diseases, things like cancer. There might be connections there that we didn't go over, but with the germline restricted chromosome, the genes that are on it are actually genes that tend to be turned on in certain types of cancer. So the more we learn about those genes in other organisms, the more we understand.
Thank you very much, Anne-Marie Diancote. And we hope to hear more of these studies. And it's an exciting time. And I think it would be great if years from now somebody who heard this show and went into genetics wants to come on Ecologic and give us the next step.
That would be amazing. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, well, thank you for coming on.
Have a good evening.
You too.
Thanks.
WBAI's environmental show, Ecologic, has moved to 11 a.m. on Tuesdays.
Ken Gale
and Donna Stein
bring you scientists,
activists,
authors,
and other experts
on climate change,
air,
water,
environmental justice,
energy, poisonous and renewable,
healthy foods,
wildlife,
and, of course, connections with other issues.
Listen every Tuesday at 11 a.m.
here on WBAI New York.
99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone?
Hi, I'm Ken Gale of WBAI's Tuesday evening environmental show Ecologic. One of the cool things about being a BAI buddy is that you get to decide what WBAI is worth to you. Are we worth more than your cable TV? Or 10 bucks a month? 20, 100, a million? Just go to the WBAI.org website and sign up with your credit card. You'll barely notice it. In return, you get a WBAI tote bag to show off, free or discounted entry to special WBAI events, and other perks. Another cool thing about being a BAI buddy is less fundraising interruptions to your favorite programs. Go to WBAI.org. You can donate in the name of your favorite show, like Ecologic.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process.
I don't want to get too much into politics, but today what I wanted to do is talk about what happens when you bring some knowledgeable people together in terms of how we go forward to address this crisis.
Senator Bernie Sanders spoke with public health leaders in Detroit, Michigan yesterday about the coronavirus. As tests become more available, more cases are being confirmed, which might bring down the death rate. But the global spread is worrying both health experts and the stock market. Yesterday, the so-called circuit breaker was triggered, suspending trading for 15 minutes for the first time since 1997. The virus has raised concerns about voter turnout today, with primaries in Michigan, Washington State, Idaho, Mississippi, Missouri, and North Dakota. In Washington, where 19 people have died from COVID-19, State Democratic Party Chair Tina Podlodowski expects high turnout.
We don't have worries about turnout because we are entirely mail-in ballots. I think that the concern would be, would people, if they were going to the polls today as opposed to entirely mail-in, would they be thinking differently?
The answer is yes, according to political science professor Travis Ridout from Washington State University.
The polling place could bring together a lot of people who are coughing and sneezing.
So could campaign events, according to WSU's Foley Institute director Cornell Clayton.
What it has done is it's kept candidates away from coming and doing rallies in the last few days. And I suspect that probably hurts Sanders more than it hurts Biden, given the nature of crowds he attracts.
Nationally, former Vice President Joe Biden has a double-digit lead over Sanders in the latest CNN poll, though Washington polls show a tight race between them. Professor Ridout says even though Sanders won Washington State in 2016,
there's a lot of kind of tactical voting going on, decision making, that who can defeat Trump is still at the top of mind for a lot of voters. And so, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it's very close.
Both candidates are on the trail in Michigan and Missouri. Former presidential candidate and Senator Cory Booker endorsed Biden yesterday at an event in Flint. Here's Biden.
Cory, not only I joke with him, I said every campaign needs a senator who was an All-American Rhodes Scholar hanging with him.
Sanders also got the nod from the Working Families Party after their first choice candidate, Senator Elizabeth Warren, dropped out last week. President Donald Trump continues to reassure the public that coronavirus is still a low risk for most Americans. Multiple members of Congress are in self-quarantine, some after interacting with a coronavirus patient who attended the Conservative Political Action Conference. 66 of the 100 U.S. senators are over 60. Health experts say older people and those with underlying health conditions are the most vulnerable to the virus. Trump's campaign postponed a Women for Trump bus tour through Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, and for the first time in months has no other rallies scheduled. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks to 2020 Talks intern Danny Gare, and thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Once every 10 years, America mounts a census and attempts to count every single person living in the country, citizens and non-citizens, immigrants, documented and undocumented alike. This is an extremely difficult goal, even under ideal circumstances. And even as the actions of the current U.S. government has created fear and uncertainty that all but ensures that many immigrants will stay in the shadows, too terrified to risk contact with any governmental official, census takers included. However, by law, namely Title 13 of the U.S. Code, the Census Bureau cannot release any information about you, your business, or your immigration status to law enforcement. So step out of the shadows. Stand up and be counted. This is a public service of WBAI Community Outreach.
The WBAI Local Station Board will meet on Wednesday, March 11th at 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue in the Borough Hill section of Brooklyn. Note, this is a change of venue. Again, the WBAI Local Station Board will meet on Wednesday, March 11th at 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons at 388 Atlantic Avenue in the Borough Hill section of Brooklyn. All are invited to attend. This is listener sponsored.